We made it. I didn't think I'd actually get all set up to actually launch spot on at 12 o'clock with Jason Bradbury and all sorts of other guest exciting things happening in this room beforehand. But we did, and we can continue with the precision and quality of timing, which is essential for all journalists and indeed followers of Origins of Modern Britain. There we have what was, for so many, an icon of the 20th century. 10 years, as you can see, after the British Broadcasting Company was first established, it had arrived in earnest. It could actually have a major building in Portland Place, and it could have the motto, "Nation shall speak peace unto nation," and evolve into the corporation that we know and appreciate today, and even have the pet name for it, Auntie Beebe. The kind of nanny of the nation, the kind of broadcasting organisation that reflects our fears, our hopes, our humours, our characteristics, and effectively entertains, informs, and educates us. And what I want to actually spend some time today focusing on is the way in which in its first 20 or so years of existence, actually first 30 or 40 years of existence, it really set that agenda. We look a little bit at radio, but primarily we'll come in terms of seminar discussion and in the latter part of this session to look at the television side of things as well. And arguably you can also look at the multimedia field that takes place within the BBC as also impacting on how we are what we are today, that kind of origins side of things. And it would be wrong for us to actually even begin to address the whole notion of the origins of modern Britain without looking at one of the main media organisations behind that. So, reminding you briefly of what we looked at last year, indeed just working through that process, the BBC was first set up as the British Broadcasting Company in 1922, 5 years later, it became the British Broadcasting Corporation. This was at a time where generally it was viewed that broadcasting was an important aspect to engage with. But did we actually in Britain want to go the same way as they did in America, where effectively if you had the money, you could buy a license and have a commercial-led service? The answer was no. Parliamentarians at the time, possibly influenced by the newspaper owners, who said, not too sure about this, you know, we need to ensure that it's carefully regulated, carefully monitored, carefully controlled. And so we had this halfway house between a non-commercial service paid for by subscription. In other words, you would subscribe by having to buy a radio license and then latterly a television license in order to access the programmes, and a state-owned company. It's often confused that the BBC, oh, it's run by the government. No, it isn't. It's totally separate. It has to be a separate, independent organisation. The government set the level at which the BBC's income is established through what's known as the Royal Charter, which is periodically reviewed every 7 or so years. Next one coming up fairly shortly. And that's an important notion to actually take on board when we look at that whole notion between the establishment, i.e. the state apparatuses, and this broadcasting company. The first Director General, of course, of the BBC was its first Managing Director, and that was John Reith. Has he been cloned, you might well say? No. But even if you've never seen a photograph of the first BBC board, if I actually said that Reith was a big, overwhelming individual, a centre person, you might sort of not be surprised to know that he's dead centre there. That's John Reith, the first managing director of the BBC, the latter director general. A couple of reminders about his character, because it's worth noting that it was Reith who coined the phrase to inform, to educate, and to entertain. He was a Scottish Calvinist. So very much zeal of the converted from that point of view. He was a fairly harsh individual who had survived World War I. He'd been injured and wounded in battle in the Great War, of course, as it was referred to in the 1920s. Ultimately, he was a fairly ruthless individual, but he did have a determined morality. In every real sense of the word, if you worked for the BBC, you either took the Reith way or the highway. Other characteristics that have been used to describe Reith, including Asa Briggs' History of the BBC, include pompous, humourless, arrogant, paranoid, self-pitying. In fact, even his daughter said that he was somewhat anti-Semitic. He was autocratic and intimidating. And he had, in general terms, a clear viewpoint about what he wanted. So he was either liked or loathed in equal measure. Any staff who worked for the BBC had to pretty much have pristine private lives. If you were divorced, you couldn't work for the BBC. End of. And in addition to that, you would also have to say he was fairly sexist insofar as there were far more men than women that were actually in the significant jobs, as we can see from that particular initial opening thing, not necessarily representative of society, and the women just getting the vote in 1921-22, but in terms of significant jobs, and that's jobs of a management level as opposed to secretarial, it was pretty much an all-male boys' club. There were a few notable changes that occurred within that, but it was pretty much not until the late 1930s, about 15 years after it had become established, that the staff association effectively began to reflect the sort of gender balance more equally. The BBC, British Broadcasting Company, latterly British Broadcasting Corporation, was supposed to be a business, but Reith turned it into a crusade. Important line to actually take from that point of view. By 1926, as they say, he shifted through the first 4 years, and the corporation developed, which had governors, but again, it wasn't directly accountable to anybody at that stage. Reith's views were quite simple. He believed that politics was one of those aspects that people got involved with, that the BBC should be above politics. He actually encouraged the whole notion of education. He wanted the very best of the country to be developed for all its listeners. He encouraged people to go into studios to educate and inform, etc. All legitimate goals and so on. But ultimately, he probably kind of had to square that circle of entertainment and education. He had a very clear view about what was right and proper and what was improper, shall we say. So the whole notion of popularised entertainment, the kind of musical variety, the popular cinema of the time and so on, would be, if not frowned, well, would be frowned upon rather than sneered by the approach the BBC actually took in terms of its approach to broadcasting and so on. Again, politically, there were a number of issues from a journalistic characteristic that you can actually use to criticise the whole Reith era, one of those being the 1926 general strike, in which the BBC effectively had a real opportunity to report extensively on the strike. Prior to that, the official line was they couldn't refer any major news stories before 7 o'clock each day, and they could only have short news bulletins. They couldn't actually sort of have anything more extensive than that, because it would have been in breach of their agreement with the government, etc. But, if you may recall, Reith took the line that actually the government was elected by the people. If the people were represented by the BBC, then effectively the strike effectively had to be against the government, so the BBC could not take sides. And it irritated a large number of left-wing thinkers and MPs as well. There was an awful lot of subtle partiality that took place. It was supposed to be impartial, but there were a whole range of behind-the-scenes censorship activities. The whole notion that to get a programme made, you had to go through several layers of bureaucracy and committee meetings before you even got to the studio, let alone actually be able to produce and transmit the whole package. And again, there was a lot of accusations that they didn't really cover things like the hunger marches of the 1930s and so on. In fact, it was most proud of its royal broadcasts. Its biggest coup was the Christmas message, the annual Christmas message by the reigning monarch. And from 1930 onwards, interventions within the BBC tended to obviously be passed off as, if they avoided a subject, it was because that subject was not in the national interest. So at a time where you have great civic unrest, you have the growth of National Socialism in Germany, you have the growth of a whole range of other activities all over Europe, here was the BBC effectively still running the spaces that its heart of empire and still developed there. So you could arguably say that in a lot of ways, the British Broadcasting Corporation was out of touch with its audience. But again, you could also say that Reith was adopting a policy of, if not necessarily appeasement, because obviously that was left to Chamberlain and so on, but a way of actually politically ensuring that the BBC was never going to be out of favour with the government, because there was no real reason. It's the danger of self-censorship. Censorship is a topic we'll come to towards the end of this piece, and again in seminar discussions when we talk about the other extreme of the BBC, where there's a whole range of feeling that BBC has actually gone too far into an immoral form of broadcasts, etc. But there were a number of notable silences until Reith effectively left in 1937. This brought us pretty much to the pre-war period, a time when, without the gas masks, the standard way in which people would access information, if they would actually accessing it through newspapers and so on, or newsreels in the cinema, would be through the ubiquitous radio. And to give you a flavour of the radio in action, so to speak, I'm sure you're all familiar with that device and sort of scenario that's actually there, I want to actually spend just a little bit of time focusing on this little number that hopefully gives you an example of one of the BBC's wartime broadcasts.
But here, Dunkirk is another English epic, and to my mind, one of the most characteristically English about it. So typical of us, so absurd and yet so grand and gallant that you hardly know whether to laugh or to cry when you read about them, was the part played in the difficult and dangerous embarkation, not by the warships, magnificent though they were, but by the little pleasure steamers. We've known them and laughed at them, these fussy little steamers, all our lives. We've called them the shilling thick. We've watched them load and unload their crowds of holiday passengers, the gents full of high spirits and bottled beer, the ladies eating pork pies, the children sticky with peppermint rock. Sometimes they only went as far as the next seaside resort, but the boldest of them might manage a channel crossing to let everybody have a glimpse of Boulogne. They were usually paddle steamers, making a great deal more fuss with all their churning than they made speed. And they weren't proud, for they let you see their works going round. They liked to call themselves queens and belles. And even if they were new, there was always something old-fashioned, a Dickens touch, a mid-Victorian air about them. They seemed to belong to the same ridiculous holiday world as pierrots and piers, sandcastles, Hammered teas, palmists, automatic machines, and crowded, sweating promenade.
Okay. So, 3 years after Reith had left the BBC, and Britain is at war. Okay? Not that the two things are connected, of course. J.B. Priestley, fairly well-known author, Time and the Hendersons, I have been here before, a whole range of other plays and texts that he'd actually positioned, originally hadn't been chosen as being one of the right voices to actually broadcast on the BBC. It was only really in the aftermath of Reith having left that the talks department effectively could use more of the popular intellectual writers and folk to actually commit to them. But you're still seeing a kind of classist approach from there. I mean, what he's actually doing there, as you can see, it says it up there, is partly producing something which is not exactly Churchillian, but still has that whole notion of Braveheart, we will see this through, all will be well with the world. It's getting into that notion of, well, where do the BBC effectively see their role in wartime? Television had ceased to be a part of the whole situation, because in 1939 the feeling was that if the BBC maintained the television transmitters, then the Nazi bombers could use them to home in on clear targets, and they would effectively sort of serve as a hindrance rather than a help. But radio kept on going. Radio was a way in which people would access their news during the war and so on. And again, if you look forward to the movie that comes out later on this year, which celebrates the Dunkirk evacuation and so on, things were fairly difficult. You know, in terms of where the nation's morale was, the BBC had a clear role to play, as Churchill himself said, in terms of what they were doing, how the issues were developing, etc. But where did they actually go? What was the register that they were actually looking to strike? Was it actually J.B. Priestley? Or was it, in 1942, just as Pearl Harbor was taking place and so on, the notion of a kind of intellectual good humour as put together by
aircraft woman, Alice Jones, from the WAF. He says, lately I've come across a word new to me. The word is allergic. Someone says he's allergic to tomatoes, for instance. Exactly what does allergic mean? Jones?
Allergic, it's a compound word derived from two Greek words. One is the word ergon, meaning work, and the other was probably the Greek word allos, meaning other. And it means, therefore, working against or working in a different sense from, or in modern terminology, reacting against, because your work is other than the work of the thing against which you are reacting.
Campbell?
The Americans use the word rather as a slang word. They say allergic to tomatoes, for instance, meaning that they upset you. I know a person, for instance, who can't eat stalk. It comes out in bright red spots. I know another man, a bald-headed chap, when he eats marmalade, the top of his head begins to steam.
Which, as we all know, if you eat marmalade and you're bald, the top of your head will begin to steam. I avoid it regularly, but there we are. But in terms of that, you have this whole notion of the register. And the reason I'm sort of spending some time on this is just to give you a sense of how that class consciousness is being reflected within the medium that we're actually listening to. Because there's still an uncertainty insofar as, on the one hand, yes, you've got folk who, clearly in the case of the Brains Trust, the focus of the programme was you got experts, quote-unquote, who would debate and discuss not necessarily general issues, but fun questions, or questions that the listener would actually send in. So there's a general line that business as usual will continue. But does that reflect society? Well, again, as I pointed out, the musical, seaside postcards, Britain has had a notorious, indeed some might say, glorious history of lampooning satirists and other aspects within that whole factor. Effectively, the first radio personality wasn't from the BBC. It was a gentleman called William Joyce. William Joyce was an English aristocrat who was a fascist. And so he was known as Lord Haw-Haw. And he would effectively transmit blatant propaganda with the line, Germany calling, regularly to, you know, the radio listeners. It was, I suppose, you could argue, early pirate broadcasting, but basic propaganda. When you've only got a few channels to choose from, and just the one BBC channel, and Radio Luxembourg and so on, you may well find that that whole issue of somebody who is even seen as a figure of fun, even though representing the enemy, will actually sort of impact on people. And it's generally thought that by, you know, the end of the 1930s, at the start of the war and so on, there were 30%, nearly a third of the population, who would listen regularly to William Joyce / Lord Haw-Haw. He was executed after the war, of course, for treason. Again, there was a notion that educated people, if you were, you know, university graduate and so on, you wouldn't be taken in by this. But there was still a notion of you would distrust the news, and therefore would you also distrust what was being said on the BBC. And there's also a sense of the BBC being too aloof, too solemn. In other words, boring. So how do you address that? Now, the music hall is one aspect. Lots of comedians and characters actually emerged and learned their trade in the music hall at the time. And you get an awful lot of double entendres coming into the alternate side of things when it was generally felt that the BBC's original decision to abandon all normal programming once war had broken out in 1939 and replace the entire WAJ with news bulletins and serious music. There were 80 composers who were actually banned because they were deemed to be not appropriate. Needed to be counterbalanced by a more entertaining approach. Hence ITMAR, It's That Man Again, or indeed the whole notion of Mrs. Mop, with the euphemism, Can I Do You Now, Sir?
Can I do you now, sir? Everyone's saying I can play the tune. And where it comes from, I need to tell you. But if you're observant, you'll hear clear and true. A sweet little voice saying, I've brought it for you. And can I do you now, sir? Can I do you now? If you don't want doing, we'll have a farewell. I've done for the best in the land in deprived. I've done everybody, but never done time. On the day of Trafalgar, what we tell to say, let every man here do his duty this day. So I keep the tradition with my gentlemen. Can I do you now, sir? GPFN. What you think I've brought for you? One of these gorgeous dumplings. She made it out of her own head. But of course she took the head in there first. Now can I do you now, sir? Can I do you now? If you don't want doing, we'll have a farewell. I'm done for the death in the land in his prime. I've done everybody, but never done time.
And I think if you wanted any more explicit relationship to the business of prostitution, and I've done everybody, do you if there's time, it's riven within that. That whole notion of basically the tart with a heart, this is mop, and a whole variety of things, TTFN, tartar for now, etc. A lot of other areas coming into that which people would say, oh, shocking, terrible, again, if you got the line and so on. But this is taking us neatly round, as I say, through the war years, through to, clearly, the success of the post-war period. You know, again, allowing for that fact that during the war, you pretty much had a division between popular culture, the musical Mrs. Mop scenario, characters like Tommy Hanley, the Ministry of Food would be represented in, you know, figures of fun and so on. Priestley, of course, was still around. And we still had that notion of, again, the BBC as being the voice of Britain. It was a topical service. The topical way in which you would actually look to develop, you know, a representation. And it's split in terms of subsequent scenarios and would remain the same for about 20 years, up until 1967, into those three strands. Again, the classic, almost traditional, all-white English family, mother, children, and so on, more than 2.4 children, three children there, kind of middle class in terms of output. You would probably listen to a combination of the light programme, maybe the home service, which would be news. The third programme, well, that was for real intellectuals, because the third programme was where you'd actually have the Shostakovichs, the Tchaikovskys, the whole range of classical composers, what effectively we now see as Radio 3. And again, the home service was pretty much the current sort of Radio 4, the light programme, as we see effectively split into what becomes Radio 1 and Radio 2. However, things are moving on. And there is something which obviously had gone dark in 1939, but resumed in full force post-war Alexandra Palace with the notions of radio with pictures, in other words, television. Working to a whole variety of other aspects and developing a whole technical approach to life and so on. But compared with radio, still relatively low impact. Until, of course, the event that really sent demand for television sets out of the stratosphere, the 1953 coronation. You know, we're now actually in terms of, obviously, the sapphire anniversary of the Elizabethan period that's actually there. This was one of those large-scale events, which, as well as having a mass audience, was certainly covered by, as you'd expect, the sole televisual broadcaster in the land, the British Broadcasting Company, with commentators such as Richard Dimbleby. Richard Dimbleby, who'd actually made his debut back in the Crystal Palace fire when he phoned in the report back in the 1930s, the collapse of Crystal Palace and so on, and obviously the father of both Jonathan Dimbleby and David Dimbleby, would probably be regarded again as one of those wonderful voices of the BBC. Again, roughly standard received pronunciation in terms of you're analysing the register, but again, putting this whole notion out of what we're seeing is reflecting what it is to be British. And as I said, this was one of the key areas that drove the population physically, but again, raised the interest and actually said, actually, we could do with more of this. We could actually sort of have our own television set, albeit monochrome, black and white, etc. And a kind of replication of what we're seeing happening in the States, but about 10 years afterwards, ballpark. Remember, we're still, I mean, rationing did not come to an end until we're actually seeing this sort of coronation happening in 1953. All the things we've spoken about in previous weeks were also beginning to develop, the mass growth of motorised transport, motorways, housing building projects, and so on and so forth. Interesting, look at the news recently, and again, the whole new notion of build your way out of recession into prosperity. But then we have to take time. We have to relax. To pause. And YouTube is wonderful, right? If there's opportunity in seminars, actually have a look at some of the interludes. Because in television terms, some of the same techniques that we used in the early days of radio were also being applied. Children could not be overstimulated. So you clearly had to have a division between after-school TV, sort of 4 or 5 o'clock time, etc., maybe the news, but also what happens post 6 o'clock. Television was not a 24/7, ever-present, all-pervasive medium which beamed out stuff. It was only pretty much on board for around about 7 to 8 hours per day. Usually from about 4 p.m, maybe slightly earlier, so it might start sort of 3 o'clock-ish or thereabouts, and then go through until midnight, and then the national anthem will be played, and then you go to bed. Okay? So that was the kind of line. And interspersed within those, you would have natural interludes, which might be the potter's wheel. It might be windmills. It might be just a case of an early version of mindfulness and actually living in the moment. But remember, the BBC is not a commercial station. It's not a commercial service. So apart from maybe trailers for other programmes, which by this stage wouldn't even be considered, you're looking at employing certain structural breaks to effectively present a whole new line to your audience, who might be eagerly awaiting such legends as Eric and Ernie. Because one of the other elements that came out of World War II, that emerged from national service, that emerged from other areas, is you had a military service which needed troop entertainment. People would go overseas and actually work for, you know, effectively, concerts which would be put on to entertain the troops. In the States, you'd have Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, and others actually sort of entertaining the masses. One other major star that emerged, of course, from the Second World War was Vera Lynn. You know, our very own nation's sweetheart. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. We'll meet again. You're seeing this gradual growth of the popular celebrity. And if you have a situation, as clearly you do, with television becoming an ever-present fixture in more and more British homes, then inevitably, comedians will emerge, as will actors, as will stars, who you're kind of inviting into your home on a regular basis, so you get to know them. So the celebrity begins to increase, and it becomes almost a virtual circle. Well, a sort of latter area here, but if you actually wanted to have a precursor to Simon Cowell's wonderful selection of X Factor material, etc., or indeed other zones such as Deal or No Deal, those two examples would be worthwhile considering. Again, you might look at some of the sort of elements in terms of YouTube to outline some of these key things. Opportunity Knocks, which was fronted by the Canadian broadcaster Huey Green, he's there, was effectively a talent show which ran actually until the mid-1970s. This, however, was not the BBC. And the reason I'm actually mentioning that is because in 1955, commercial television entered the picture. And the BBC is faced with a big decision to make. Does it continue producing very, very important, solid broadcasts where newsreaders are not allowed to actually have their face shown in public, and all you get are news bulletins and you have a whole separate sort of notion of working through that? Or do you begin to embrace what ITV wholeheartedly embraced right from the off in 1955, which is commercialisation and American pizzazz and so on? Well, again, I'll leave it to yourselves to discuss which way we actually work through this. But Opportunity Knocks was a talent show. There's some of the sort of folk here. You would actually go from Peterson Lee, Freddie Parrotface Davis, Lena Zavaroni, a muscle-bound building chap who would actually wiggle his muscles in very strange and surreal ways, which might cause shock at seminar sessions. So I just give you a warning for that when I actually will put that through. And a whole variety of other sort of areas within that. Take Your Pick was effectively, we're seeing a little slide here from the gong element, that if the person actually answered yes or no, then effectively the gong would sound and it would be eliminated. So a whole range of other things there. So game shows suddenly becoming involved. Fairly simplistic game shows. Talent shows. American imports coming through in a whole variety of bits and pieces. And countermining that, of course, you've still got the notion of reporting on national conditions. There's Richard sort of in full force there on location commentating on his own sort of sequence. I asked the question rhetorically, where would the BBC actually go with respect to when ITV came on as clearly the alternative? And again, it's an interesting class-based system, because standardly you'd say, if you were middle class or upper class, you would probably have a deal with the sort of tripe and rubbish that would actually be focused on independent commercial television, because you just wouldn't be in for that sort of thing. Interestingly enough, a similar kind of argument occurs in the 1960s when BBC Two was established very much as a more forward-thinking station, etc. But these two characters, who'd emerged from the radio show Hancock's Half Hour, were again classic examples of celebrities who developed through the BBC in terms of popularity. In terms of the kind of humour that comes out of the World War II, Mrs. Pitmar and so on, Sid James actually from South Africa, but the ever-put-upon man, you've got here again a classic case of representing. If you actually were asked to deconstruct that particular image that you've got there without knowing anything about the actors Sid James and Tony Hancock, you might sort of think, okay, two probably lower middle class blokes, not at the best prime time, etc., generally bemoaning their lot in life. You know, it's wet, it's miserable, etc. And we kind of laugh with them, but we laugh at them as well. Again, Hancock had a very complex emotional and personal life. Generally regarded as a comedy genius when working with the playwrights Galton and Simpson. There were lots of instances where, you know, because of the fame and the huge amounts of fame that sort of came to him, etc., maybe there were questions about whether he could handle it and so on and so forth. And clearly that's food and drink for the press, who at this stage have decided, actually, why not actually start using exposés to actually run about stars and what they get up to in their private lives and so on and so forth. We're also seeing, in terms of television, a range of other generic forms opening up. Has anybody ever heard of Quatermass? Oh. No Quatermass, written by Nigel Neal, no Doctor Who. This was the BBC's first attempt at a science fiction-based serial, which again proved extraordinarily popular, to the extent that Hammer effectively made three Quatermass movies that actually worked on that basis. Quatermass X the Unknown, Quatermass and the Pit, and the Quatermass Experiment. And that the adventures of Bernard Quatermass and the British Rocketry Group, kind of television equivalent of Dan Dare. So what are we seeing here? We're also seeing programming which is kind of family-oriented, but it's also action-adventure. It's the equivalent, if you like, to, as I mentioned, Pilot of the Future, Dan Dare, and so on. There's another Director General, lots of other folk coming through. shocked to find that the group I took on Monday did not know the name of the current BBC Director General. I do hope this afternoon's group, when we're back in this building, will not sort of give me total silence when I say, so who's the current Director General of the BBC? Logos are changing, times are changing, colour is coming in. You know, we're seeing, again, over a 10-year period, by the time things are launching within that, a whole shift in people's outset to how the BBC is viewed and so on. If you remember, we started off with the slide of Broadcasting House. Now we have the concrete donut. No longer there, gone, of course, they've even disaggregated to Manchester, Salford, etc. So I actually did my sort of stuff back in the 1980s and various other routines. But in terms of that whole sequence, you've got clearly a good example of a modern, contemporary, forward-thinking corporation. Yes, there's competition, but actually that competition is viewed in general as being very good for the BBC. Because in terms of the pace and the dynamism that some of the programmes, often supported by large numbers of American imports, have provided, it's also given another alternative for developing programmes, etc. The reverse, of course, being the case, that one of the aspects of the BBC which does help is that they don't chase ratings. They can actually allow shows time to percolate into the consciousness. Shows like Dad's Army, Monty Python's Flying Circus, and so on. All areas which initially got very low viewing figures and would have been cancelled pretty much immediately if they were on a commercial system. So again, allowing shows time to breathe and develop was something else that actually was seen as a good thing. Case in point, Steptoe and Son. Again, another Galton and Simpson scenario, a comedy about Rag and Bone, father and son, as the name suggests. But again, cult viewing. Also representing other areas of the time. Things that we'll be going on to consider, such as the playwrights John Osborne and various other factors. Again, reminding you in terms of the context of these things, we're now shifting into an era post-Suez. Harold Macmillan is saying, you've never had it so good. And yet maybe some people actually want to reflect on that. They want to see how society was developing, etc. And they want to have a laugh. And what's life like if you can't have a laugh? He's Canadian. I wonder, does anybody in this room appreciate the two cult series that this man was responsible for? One for ITV and the other one for BBC. Anybody want to go for it? Is absolutely correct. Doctor Who for BBC and the other one? The Avengers. Not the Captain America Avengers, but the Avengers with John Steed and Emma Peel, who again will look back for ITV. Although, it's quite worth pointing out that had it not been for Verity Lambert, the first producer, female producer for Doctor Who, standing her ground and subtly ignoring Newman's suggestion he didn't want bug-eyed monsters, and then of course the Daleks came along 4 weeks in, he kind of retracted it slightly earlier. But again, he's part of that show business impresario. You could argue that an equivalent, a possibly even greater character in ITV, was Lou Grade, Lord Grade, who was Michael Grade's father. Again, people who had actually cut their teeth in the business of show. They were show business entertainers. They knew what made people actually tune in. They knew what they were looking for and focusing on as well. But we've also said the BBC is designed to reflect the nation. And not everything in the 1960s is perfect, as we'll go on to see. Not only have we got ideologies changing, we've got shifting scenarios, we're in the heart of the Cold War, we've also got the Vietnam situation, we've also got moral changes. This documentary, drama documentary to be precise, was something that created a great furore in the 1960s because it portrayed the tale of an unmarried mother who effectively had to give up her baby. And there were some very, even today, heart-rending scenes. Whole notion of Up the Junction squeeze had a hit in the 1980s, coping on that sort of basis. But again, it's addressing that whole area of social realism and actually providing programmes which they might not be entertaining in the acceptable views of entertaining, but they certainly were thought-provoking and provocative, and they got people talking about whether this was appropriate, how things were developing. a lot of the soap operas, which in their own way had also emerged from radio in the 1940s, when Procter & Gamble were the first major company to fund ongoing series, hence the term Procter & Gamble, responsible for soaps, will create this sort of soap opera. Again, they'd been imported. This wasn't a soap opera, this was a one-off drama, but there were other areas that were being developed within the soap opera field, one of which, of course, would have greatly upset the lady on the right there. Filth, filth, and more filth. Again, we'll be talking about Mary Whitehouse in terms of her approach. Mary was actually one of the National Viewers and Listeners Association's early chairman, and she was very keen to clean up TV and to avoid all this filth and innuendo and problematic issues that were being raised there. And there are lots of examples of her letters which effectively impact on the individual, which again we'll be sharing in terms of how things are going. You can see there the actual title of the text, Cleaning Up TV. Why was she so concerned with that? And why do we still look back and some people say she was right, and some people say no, she's wrong, etc. But again, it's because it's such a popular mass medium. Television, at this stage, you know, it's relatively straightforward to get audiences of 14 to 15 million. Audiences of 25 to 30 million are not unheard of for certain events and programmes, because there isn't the competition as such. You don't have 60-odd channels and time-delayed viewing and all their other packets to work through. But there is probably one of the better examples of the soap opera. Where did it come from? ITV. Now, one thing I didn't mention was on the opening night of ITV, it was generally argued that BBC attempted to put a spoiler out by actually on radio broadcasting the death of one of their most famous characters, Grace Archer from The Archers, died in a fire. On the grounds of, ooh, you know, big furore about that. A lot of debates and talks about that, particularly given that there's a conference on The Archers in this very university in a few weeks' time. But in terms of Coronation Street, this, again, was originally decided, it is designed to be a six-week series, but again, it tapped into that notion of, you could argue, a classic British fantasy. One is looking backwards at a time where the local community is so enclosed, so connected, that the streets of Weatherfield and this Coronation Street is very much a kind of classic sort of representation of the North. Maybe so, maybe no. Again, it's entirely up to yourselves to actually decide how real that actually was. It's certainly something which was deemed to be important. You know, you wanted more substance to your dramas. You wanted to ensure you had classic characters who you could identify with as an audience. You could argue that soap operas from Coronation Street through to Angels, through to EastEnders, through to Hollyoaks and so on are simply modern-day contemporary adult morality plays. You know, they're ways of actually saying, look, if you actually have various affairs, if you maybe abuse drugs, if you steal and so on, things will, you know, go wrong for you and so on. But again, that's another debate. The fact of the matter is, television is now in its heyday, both from the point of view of BBC and ITV and so on. Even though we're well aware that it's an artifice, that in terms of adventures, in terms of scenarios there, whether it's Zed cars, which again increases the pace, increases the notion of how people actually, increases the realism. There's a character called Dixon of Dock Green, who was a predecessor to Zed cars, who again carried with that sort of notion that actually this is not reality. And there's a sort of sense that you wanted more reality in terms of the characters we were seeing and so on, more adventure, more dynamism and so on. So to summarise, we've shifted from BBC Radio going through various stages of existence. We are just beginning to see the way in which it reflects society's norms, reflects society's values and so on. All of the slides I've shown you have all featured white individuals and mostly white males. And that is also going to change. But there's also a notion of how the normalisation works and how, again, we're represented with elements, and we'll be looking certainly in terms of that, in terms of immigration and so on, at how the BBC constructs, reconstructs, and reflects particular values back to its viewers and listeners. Thanks for your time, and I'll see you, some of you, in this very building in a couple of hours or so from now. And make sure you sign the register.